potential today from sheriffs and police chiefs, detectives across this country and really across the globe to understand the power of DNA, technology, and solving crime.
Welcome to this month's edition of the FBI National Academy Associates Leadership APB podcast series. My name is John Kennedy, and I'm the Director of Education and Training for the FBI National Academy Associates. I'll be your moderator today. The Leadership APB podcast series engages law enforcement and public safety executives in discussions on timely and current topics affecting first responders around the world. These leaders will share with you their leadership and managerial philosophies, successes, and obstacles that they have encountered in their careers. The podcast series are free audio programs distributed to FBI National Academy Associates members, their staffs, and other law enforcement executives that provide our communities, states, countries, and profession with the highest degree of law enforcement professionalism and expertise. We're here today with former Congressman and King County Sheriff Dave Reichard, who brings nearly 50 years of public service experience to his latest role as Vice President at Gordon Thomas Honeywell Governmental Affairs and a consultant with Thermo Fisher Scientific. During his 14-year career as U.S. Congressman, Dave was a member on the Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness and Ways and Means Committees. But today, we'll be focusing on his 33-year career in law enforcement and specifically his role as sheriff of King County Sheriff Washington, where he was the lead investigator on the Green River Killer serial murder case. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks.
Dave, you spent much of your law enforcement career working to solve the Green River Killer case. During the 20-year span of the case, you wore a series of different hats, each with more leadership responsibilities. Can you speak to the evolution of this case and how important leadership was in solving the case?
In early 1982, in August, we recognized we had a serial case. Of course, everyone was supportive. The command staff was supportive. The elected officials in the county were supportive. They wanted us to solve this case. The detectives were excited about solving the case. They felt like the community, the elected officials, and the command staff were behind them in their efforts. But as the case moved on through the months and years, that support ebbed and flowed, and the leadership from the elected officials dissipated. The leadership from the command staff was affected by the lack of leadership by the county council, which is the elected body that determines the budget for the investigation. And as a result of the elected officials not leading the way and supporting our efforts, the command staff then eroding their support, eventually what happens is that the detectives become demoralized, don't feel like the community or elected officers are supporting them, and the case was cut back. We started up again, and again, that excitement was regenerated. The command staff was there for us, the elected officials, the budget was there. But then body after body after body, people lost faith in the task force and believed that we weren't going to solve the case. But the detectives on the case never gave up. And I think that's one of the true signs of leadership is that persistence. And it's the persistence that's driven by, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but it's driven by the dedication, commitment, and compassion that investigators have for the victims and their families. And part of my job in moving through the case at different levels of management was to make sure that the detectives were motivated, that they never gave up. And part of that is that I've always believed that there is always a way, that you never give up. There is always an answer. And that's how we eventually solved this case, is that detectives, the entire team was persistent. And so that leadership of persistence and support from all levels of government and the community and the command staff is absolutely critical for success.
Dave, during the course of the case, what was your interaction with the victims' families?
Well, the families never give up. The families never stop hoping, especially if your child is missing. There is still hope that that little daughter, in this case, is still alive. And so there's a hope there. There were some families that kept the bedrooms of their daughters exactly the same as the day that they had left. And in some cases, we found the bodies of some of these little girls and young women years later. And those bedrooms were still kept in the same way. They still celebrated their birthdays. They still bought them Christmas presents. And so the detectives related to the passion, the love that the families had for their daughters. And in that, you become very close to the mothers and the fathers, the grandparents, all of the relatives and families. You are their conduit now to answers. There's never closures for these families, by the way. It's a term that's no longer used. We learned back in the 80s rather quickly, there is never closure for the families. They only have answers to questions about their daughter's disappearance or about their daughter's death. And the closeness of the detectives is a lot of times it was phone calls for some families, always checking in. What's the progress? What do you know? For some, it was even more of a close relationship. They would come to the task force office. They would bring cakes. And Bertie Winston, one of the mothers of one of the victims, Tracy Winston, would bring chocolate chip cookies. And we'd sit down and visit and talk about the progress in her daughter's case specifically. And then, of course, with the other cases, too. In one case, I was asked to be a pallbearer at one of the young girls, 16-year-old girl's funeral. And so you become very connected, very close to the families. You feel their pain. You really can't understand that pain, obviously, because I'm not the one who lost my daughter, but you can sure identify with it, have compassion for them. And that's what really drove me, and I think drove the other detectives, is this feeling that I had three children who were young, two daughters, 8 and 9 years old when I started this case. And I could certainly feel, I get a little emotional about this, but their loss was so tragic. They can never heal from that. Their daughter is totally removed from their life.
Truly heartbreaking for the families and the detectives. How important is it for leadership to understand how emerging technology could affect the possibility of a successful conclusion in cases such as Green River?
Yeah, Green River is just a, is a real stark example of, if you can imagine for a minute that we had the DNA technology, if that technology had existed in 1982. Ridgway was arrested in the first quarter of 1982 for patronizing a prostitute here in Washington State in King County. And in July, we start finding bodies. Wendy Caulfield is first, Deborah Bonner is second, Opal Mills, Marsha Chapman, Cynthia Hines, found on the same day on August 15th. Those bodies in July and August, especially the bodies in August, we were able to recover bodily fluids, evidence from those bodies, place them in a test tube, and freeze them. If we had DNA technology back then, we could have taken the samples from the victims found in early 1982 and compared them with Ridgway's DNA immediately. And what would have had to happen, of course, is that in some states today, when you're arrested, DNA is a swab is taken and your DNA is entered into the database. We would have had Ridgway's DNA profile in a database at the time he was arrested for patronizing a prostitute. We could have entered the DNA profiles from the victims in the Green River in August of 1982, that comparison would have revealed that Ridgway was the killer. And here's really the stark numbers. We would have only had 6 victims instead of over 60 victims if that DNA science had existed back in 1982. So the potential today for sheriffs and police chiefs, detectives across this country and really across the globe to understand the power of DNA technology in solving crime. And we could even talk about rapid DNA and how it could be applied to solving property crimes that could go on and solve other serious assaults and rapes. As we look at rapid DNA and its potential in today's world, it's fairly new science that's coming online that a lot of police departments and sheriff's offices across the country are beginning to recognize. But this new technology today also expands out to familial researching databases that are out there. And that's what you're reading in the newspapers today, out of California and other states that are doing groundbreaking work on discovering how they can solve cold cases through familial DNA research.
In your opinion, as you just mentioned, the advantages of science and in particular rapid DNA, what are some of the more recent ways that this can assist in solving criminal cases?
I think that there is potential here to make dramatic impacts on the way that cases are investigated. For example, if I was a detective back in the old days with no DNA evidence to use, I would go to a homicide scene. I would collect the evidence at the scene. I would have maybe a list of suspects. Let's say that the husband's a suspect, the boyfriend, the neighbor, grandfather, a friend. I've got 5 or 6 suspects, and I start to investigate. Our team investigates each one of those. Well, several of those people are innocent people, but we're going to investigate them anyway. And we can build a case in some of those for probable cause to make an arrest, probable cause to search their homes, search their places of work, and follow that lead and discover later that an innocent person has just been arrested, an innocent person has been, their house has been searched by the police, all legal, of course. But still, the innocent person goes through a pretty traumatic experience going through that while the police are trying to figure out who the suspect is. But imagine in today's world that if you go to a crime scene and you take a swab and there's enough DNA evidence, let's just say it's for discussion purposes, it's blood, and you take a swab of what you believe is the suspect's blood, you take that swab, you put it in a plastic cartridge, you put it in a rapid machine. In 90 minutes, you'll get a DNA profile. Well, that's a huge lead. And of course, you have to build the rest of your case. But now instead of looking at 5 different suspects or 6 different suspects, you're able to, as an investigator, focus and narrowly focus, I should say, on one suspect because you have his or her DNA at the crime scene. And then you can begin to build your case from there. And the important piece of that is that you not only are focused on someone's whose DNA is at the scene and most potentially is the person who committed the crime, has the most potential to be the person who committed the crime. You also eliminate that conflict between the police and an innocent individual. And especially important, I think, in today's world, when you look at the mistrust that people have around law enforcement. If you can eliminate that negative contact between, and this is just one instance, between an innocent person and an investigator trying to find the bad guy, and especially if that person is a person of color, and there's automatically an inference by that person that the only reason they're being investigated is because they are a person of color, that just helps feed the narrative that police are biased. So if we can eliminate some of those contacts, we can begin to eliminate, in my opinion, the perception that there is a systematic bias in law enforcement across this country. I personally don't believe that's true. I've spent 33 years in law enforcement, and I would say 99.9% of the officers that I worked with across the country are people who are committed, who are driven to do the right thing and treating people equally, apply the law equally across the board. But that's just one application of how new technology can help police chiefs and sheriffs and the community begin to show in a positive way, look, we're only looking for the bad guy. And rapid DNA, in my opinion, is one of those ways that we can do that.
Dave, with the recent calls for police reform, what would be your advice to police leaders on hiring the right people and building trust in the communities?
I do think that it's important, you know, when you look at law enforcement day today, some of the other things that could be done is really, in some cases, police departments, sheriff's offices in some parts of the country are already doing this, but really focusing on hiring the right person. And this goes back to your leadership question in the beginning, because I believe that the right person is a person who understands clearly that they're coming to this job as a cop, that they understand clearly their job is to serve the people. I call it the heart of a servant. The heart of a servant is absolutely one of the most sought after characteristics in law enforcement. And that's what I was looking for when I was the sheriff. So you understand that you're serving the people. You want to build trust with the people, which means that you're going to be honest with the community that you serve. And honesty is good, but you want to build integrity. So you have to have consistent honesty. So you have a person who's coming to law enforcement knowing that they have the heart of a servant, knowing they want to serve the community, they want to build integrity through consistent honesty, and then that builds a team. So not only a team within your particular police department, but it builds a community team based upon those two simple ideas of service and integrity, and then that's when people become leaders. And that's, to me, hiring the right person with that quality is absolutely critical. Training, of course, is important, and yearly training, bi-yearly training, using less lethal technology so that firearms are the last line of force that the police officer has a choice in using. And then, of course, we've always talked about for the many years I was in law enforcement, and that's just community involvement. And that goes back to being a heart of a servant and building that honesty and integrity with the community that you serve. And I think in that way, we can rebuild the entire criminal justice system and rebuild trust in law enforcement.
Dave, it's been a pleasure to be able to talk with you today. Again, thank you for taking the time to share your thoughts on the Green River case and the use of DNA testing and technology to solve it. We are also looking forward to you joining us at the FBI National Academy of Associates 57th National Annual Training Conference in Orlando on July 7th through the 10th, where you'll be able to share with our members much more details on this case.
Thank you for having me be a part of your podcast presentation. I look forward to the event in July. And again, just appreciate the time to be with you today. Thank you.
We'd also like to thank Thermo Fisher Scientific for their support in bringing you today's podcast. This concludes our broadcast. We hope that you will be able to join us again for the next edition of the Leadership APB podcast series. Please stay safe and well. Goodbye for now.